Wow, we have mood lighting. Also, all of a sudden, I cannot see anyone. So I'm going to trust that you're all smiling and agreeing with me. So hello, everyone. Welcome to my session. I honestly cannot remember the name of my session. Duke, front row, what's the name of the session? No, it's Discover What's New in Windows. In my defense, I submitted this session. The title I submitted was What's New in Hyper-V. Seemed like a good title to me, but they changed it around. So anyway, I'm Ben Armstrong. I'm a principal program manager lead on Hyper-V, often known as Virtual PC Guy. And today I am here to try and run you through everything that is new in Windows Server 2016 in the world of Hyper-V and virtualization. Really been looking forward to this session. And so we've got a lot of material to cover, so I do want to get going. People coming in the back, please feel free to come in, find a seat. On the plus side, I am the last session today, so technically I can go over. On the downside, 15 minutes before the session ends, they start serving beer in the expo hall. So I am also painfully aware that some of you are going to be antsy to be up and leaving. So we'll try and hit the time exactly, but see how we go. One thing I do want to be very upfront about is that Windows Server 2016 is a huge release for Hyper-V, and I am going to be scrambling to cover everything. So I'm not going to be going hugely deep in a lot of these features. A lot of these features, I really just want to make you aware that it's there, understand the problems we're solving, and why you want to care about this. And I'll be giving you pointers at the end of this deck and presentation about where you can go to find out more information. I'm going to be here all week. I'm spending a lot of time down at the Hyper-V booth, so please, if you see something which you're like, man, I need to know more about that, come and find us, come and chat to us. We're also going to be publishing a lot of information. But to give just an idea of the volume, here we put together a little list of kind of the main features in Windows Server 2012, 2012 R2. And if we take this list and add on the features for Windows Server 2016 down the bottom in the blue, you'll see it's actually kind of just as many features again. I've had a lot of people coming by the booth already where they come asking what's new in Hyper-V and Windows Server 2016, and they're really expecting me to be like, oh, there's these two cool new features. No, there's a huge amount of stuff here. And I am so happy to have announced that we have the eval out and GA is coming out in October. Personally, I run pre-release stuff in my lab at work, but in my home environment, I always run RTM. I am dying to deploy Windows Server 2016 on my systems. So let's go through. I've taken all the work that we've done and I've bucketed it into some big high-level areas. The first area is security. This is a big investment for us. And I want to take some time to set the stage a bit and explain why we're focusing on this so much. The first reason is, let's be honest, the security landscape for IT is worse than it has ever been. We are seeing higher frequency of security attacks and exploits. We're constantly seeing news about different companies getting compromised, having data stolen. We're seeing news about how the sophistication of these attacks are going up, and we have to just continue to invest in making sure that Windows Server is the best platform and the safest platform for running your stuff on. But the second thing that I'm really excited about here is I've been out talking to people about cloud computing for a long time now. For 6-7 years, I've been out talking about cloud computing. And as cloud computing has been becoming more and more real for people, one of the biggest reasons why people have said we can't use cloud computing comes down to industry and government regulations. I would talk to customers who would say, well, we get the idea of cloud computing. We get why this would be interesting. We get why we should be looking at this. But I work in a regulated industry, or I work in a country where there are legal requirements. This isn't going to happen. And the thing that frustrated me most about that whole conversation was that very much the attitude and the opinion that was coming across was, this isn't a problem that you can solve with technology. This is a political problem, this is a legal problem, and there's nothing you can do about that. Now, as an engineer, that offends me deeply. You can solve every problem with technology. Now, you shouldn't solve every problem with technology, but this one, I'm very proud of what we've been able to do here. So let's dig in a little. One of the big features that we have coming in Windows Server 2016 is an end-to-end solution that we call Shielded Virtual Machine. And we actually have two sessions where we go through what it's like to deploy shielded virtual machines. We talk through the architecture. I have details on those sessions at the end of this deck. But shielded virtual machines are comprised of three pieces of technology. The first core piece of technology is the virtual TPM. So we now allow you for generation two virtual machines, you can add a virtual TPM to your virtual machine, and you can use that for things like BitLocker and protecting the virtual machine. Then on top of that, we have the concept of shielding a virtual machine. Shielding a virtual machine is where you say, okay, I'm going to take this virtual machine and I'm going to make it so that the host administrator can't access it. Now, why is this important? Because there are lots of situations, you know, in service providers, in public clouds, where the host administrator needs to keep the hardware running, needs to be able to manage the fabric, but should not have access to the virtual machine. So we go through and we cut off all that access. And the final, you know, component in this is the host guardian service. And the host guardian service is an external service that is responsible for validating and ensuring the health of the Hyper-V server before allowing a shielded virtual machine to run. So the idea here is, if you have a shielded virtual machine, it is, you're using BitLocker, you're encrypting, you're protecting it. If a malicious player tries to interfere with the host, they've somehow tampered with the host, and they're hoping to start that virtual machine and then access it, the host guardian service is able to validate whether that virtual machine should be allowed to start on it. So that's the end-to-end solution. But something extra that we've done on top of this, we did a lot of work and investment in shielded virtual machines, and this is kind of our top-tier solution. But when we were talking to customers, as we've been going through the technical previews with this, there were two pieces of data that came out. The first one was, there were a lot of our customers who said, I don't actually need the full shielded virtual machine story. I work in a regulated industry, and the regulation is, I need to ensure that my data is encrypted. Like, that's the bar I have to meet. I don't need this full experience. At the same time, they said, we have older applications, older workloads that run on Windows Server 2008, run on Windows 7, don't run in Generation 2 virtual machines. So something I'm happy to talk about for the first time here is we've built a solution for providing protection for Generation 1 virtual machines as well. This is a solution called the Key Storage Drive, and I'll demonstrate this in a moment. It is not as high security as a shielded virtual machine, it's not as high security as a virtual TPM, but it does provide a way to safely use BitLocker inside a Generation 1 virtual machine in these environments. I'll show you what that looks like. The third point is, this is another first time we're talking about this on stage, and I'm really happy to be talking about this because this is some really cool technology. Quickly, a show of hands. My eyes are adjusting to the light so I can actually see faces and I'll be able to see hands raised. How many people here have heard about the credential guard feature that we did in Windows 10 desktop? Cool. So I'm seeing about half the hands raised. For the hands that weren't raised, credential guard is some amazing technology that we worked with the security team in Windows, where we're able to use the Hyper-V hypervisor to protect key credentials from users in Windows. And the effect of this is quite startling. because we can take a Windows system and we can make it so that even if you have malware running with admin access on your copy of Windows, it still can't steal your credentials because they're protected by the hypervisor. Well, two things to call out. The first one is that same technology is available on Windows Server. And I would strongly encourage you should have this turned on your server. You do not, we don't ever want to see malware on your server, but you absolutely want to have protection if and when that happens. But the second thing that I'm really excited to talk about for the first time on stage is we are now supporting Credential Guard inside of virtual machines. And it is really easy to turn on. So if you're running Windows 10 or Windows Server 2016 inside a virtual machine running on top of Hyper-V on Windows Server 2016, it is literally set three register keys, and you now have the highest level of protection for your credentials. The final thing I want to talk about in the realm of security before I dive over and show some demonstrations is the work we did for Linux Secure Boot. Another show of hands. How many people here are familiar with Secure Boot? Good. Once again, I'd say about half the room. It's actually been something that's been really frustrating for me is not enough people are as excited about Secure Boot as they should be. If you talk to people who have experience, managing systems in the field, it's very easy, very well known. It's like, what's the worst thing that can happen to a system in a security exploit is you get a rootkit. That is game over. And you get a rootkit on a system, your only option, one, is maybe you format and throw out the system, but maybe you don't even trust it then. Your only option is okay, fine, that system is dead to me now. Let's start over. Secure Boot protects against rootkits. And Secure Boot is a technology where we can guarantee that the kernel mode code that is running on your system is from a vendor that you trust. Now, the really cool thing here is there are two things to highlight. The first thing is we have done a lot of work, Microsoft as a company, to be able to provide Secure Boot to Linux vendors as well. So if you have a trusted Linux vendor, be it Canonical, be it Red Hat, be it other, be it Oracle, you can get offerings from them that you can run on a server knowing that only kernel mode code from that vendor is running on that system. So that's really cool. The second thing, though, is when we released Windows Server 2012 R2, we came out, we announced Generation 2 virtual machines, and we said, hey, we've got this new thing. It's an entirely new approach. And one of the things on the day we released 2012 R2, which was only 3 years ago, was at that stage we didn't have Linux running in Generation 2 virtual machines. And we had a lot of people asking, is this some evil ploy from you guys? Why aren't you supporting Linux? And we said, look, we're working on it. We're working with the Linux community. We haven't got that working yet. And a lot of people didn't really believe us. And since then, we've continued to work with the Linux community. We've got Linux running inside of Generation 2 virtual machines. We've got a lot of our new features running on Linux. And we've added support for Secure Boot when using Linux virtual machines. Final thing to talk about. This is actually kind of a neat thing. I hope that no one ever sees this in the field. There are a couple of technologies I'm going to talk about in this session, which I find fascinating because there are situations where we have built technology into Windows Server to address issues that we have seen in our Azure data centers. But because Azure runs on exactly the same copy of Hyper-V that Windows Server runs on, that Windows Desktop runs on, you all get the benefit of the work that we did for Azure. So one of the interesting things about Azure, and I'm sure this will shock and amaze many of you, is that lots of people try and hack Azure. Every day, we have people trying to break into Azure. And one of the common things we see is we see people buying virtual machines and trying to find escapes, trying to figure out how to break into the Azure fabric from a virtual machine. Now, one of the things that we're incredibly proud of is no one succeeded. Yay, you know, good engineering. But one of the things that's been frustrating is while people haven't succeeded, what they have succeeded in doing is, man, do they chew up a lot of resource while they're poking around and trying to figure out how to escape from the virtual machine. So we built a technology that we call host resource protection. And what we do is, as the virtual machine is running, we monitor what's happening inside the virtual machine, and we look for, you know, activity that we shouldn't see from a well-behaving operating system. And if we see that, we go, this is probably someone who's trying to attack the platform, and we just throttle back their resource usage. We just slow down the CPU, we slow down the storage, we go, we're not gonna let you, you keep on doing whatever you're doing, it's fine, but we're not going to let you disrupt other virtual machines on the system. Now, as I said, hopefully you'll never see this. If you do see this in Hyper-V, you will actually see we put in the status column, host resource protection enabled to inform you that this is going on. The amusing story is the reason why we put that in the status column was when we first turned this feature on, we accidentally broke Mark Krasinovich's presentation. Mark Krasinovich has this great presentation that he does on malware hunting, where he has a set of virtual machines that are just absolutely overflowing with every malware known to man. And when we put this in Windows, it went out in one of the Windows Insider flights, and a week later we had Mark on the phone going, what have you guys done? All my virtual machines are running really slowly. And it took us a day or two to figure out what was going on. So we had to tell him, like, okay, there's a saying, go turn it off. And we put the information in the UI. So now let's switch across and let me show you what these things look like in action. There we go. So I just have, just so you're aware, I'm doing all of this demo on my laptop. I'm running the Windows 10 Anniversary Edition. And I have a million virtual machines. I believe I'm consuming about 40 IP addresses right now. So let's bring up the first virtual machine. The other thing to be aware of is all my desktop backgrounds are cats. I like to have different desktop backgrounds, and I chose the cat theme for this. So you're gonna see a lot of cats in this. Actually, show of hands, how many people here are cat people? Okay, how many people are dog people? Ooh, I should have gone with dogs. Ah, oh, that's awkward. Okay, note to self, next time use dogs. So this is a generation 2 virtual machine, and I have enabled the virtual TPM on this. So what you'll see is we now have the security tab, I've got secure boot enabled on this virtual machine, and I've got the TPM enabled. Now there are some more options, I'll show you what those are in a moment. But inside the virtual machine, there are a couple of things I can pull up. The first thing is I can show I have BitLocker set on this virtual hard drive. Now, why is that important? A lot of people don't like to think about this, but you know, if you have a virtual machine running on someone else's hardware, it takes 5 seconds to shut down that virtual machine, double-click on the VHD, and mount it. And you have access to the data. That doesn't happen here. It is BitLockered, it is protected. The host does not have access to the keys. I can't access this data from the host. The next thing to show is this is actually a system that I have enabled credential guarding. So if I bring up system info and I have a look at this, we can see that credential and device guard are running. So if I got malware on here, it's not going to affect my system. So that's the next thing. And the final thing I want to show is if I bring up Device Manager, you can see I have my security device, I have the TPM. So that's all there. Now let me quickly, I'm going to shut down this virtual machine so I can show you some of the TPM options on it and the other security options. So there we've shut down. I'm going to bring up the settings. If I go to security, you see I've got secure boot enabled. I said I've got a TPM. There's another option here, which I can check, which says encrypt the state of the virtual machine and the migration traffic. So by default, you enable the TPM. We're not doing any extra encryption. We're relying on you to use BitLocker, use some other encryption technology inside the virtual machine, and we give you data at rest protection. But what about if someone is doing a wiretap in your environment? Well, you can check this box, and what we will do is anytime we're handling any assets to do with this virtual machine, any of the memory, any migration, we're going to encrypt it. Now, obviously, that comes with a performance impact, which is why we don't enable it by default. But if you need that, you can enable that. Now, the final thing is I can enable shielding. So let's do that. If I enable shielding, this becomes the world's most boring demo in the world, because I can start this virtual machine, and it's going to tell me, you can't connect. It's a shielded virtual machine. You can't do anything with it. And right now, the only way to connect to this virtual machine is over the network. Now, the obvious question that people ask when they see this is like, well, can you just shut it down and turn shielding back off? I was like, yes, I can, because I'm not using the full end-to-end solution with the Guardian service. So I'd encourage you to go to the session that we have that goes into how to construct the full end-to-end session there, system there. Now let's go over to this system. This is my generation one system with the key storage drive. So log in, get my password wrong, which is embarrassing because these all have the same password. Different cat. So if I bring up my PC here, you'll see, once again, I have BitLocker enabled, but I also have a floppy drive. That's how we know it's a generation one virtual machine. I have a floppy drive. And if we go into the settings, what you'll actually see is there's this new thing called the key storage drive. And what this is a virtual hard drive that we've attached to the virtual machine. If I bring up disk management, you will see that I have this little 40 meg hard drive here. And when I enabled BitLocker, I said, please store the keys there. So why is this important? Why is this useful? Well, the key thing to understand here is that we are using the same technology, the same encryption, the same methods to protect the contents of that key storage drive as we do the virtual TPM. So we're able to make the same sorts of promises for data at rest encryption. I do want to be clear, this is not as good as having a generation two virtual machine with a virtual TPM. It is certainly not as good as having a shielded virtual machine. But if you have requirements to have data at rest protection for a generation one virtual machine, the key storage drive can help you out there. So the final thing I do want to just quickly show is I have my Linux virtual machine here, which is configured with secure boot enabled. I have selected the certificate for Linux operating systems. And if I come in here, log in, can very quickly, I put together a little shell script that dumps the information from the UEFI firmware to say, yeah, secure boot's enabled. So even when I'm running Linux, I can get these high levels of security guarantees. So that's the security demo. And let's jump over and talk about the next thing. And that's, And that's availability. And availability is a big topic, which is actually really something I care about deeply, and something that I spend a lot of time talking to customers about. And I like to say, you know, I spent a couple of years making my customers, when I go do customer site visits, I spent a couple of years making people really depressed and angry, which is a fun thing to do. Because I've been going out and I've been meeting with customers, and when I go out and visit people, most people are happy to have me come in because they're like, we want to talk about all the cool stuff and talk about what we want to see in the next release of Hyper-V. And I've been going out to people and I've been sitting down with them and I've been saying, so can you tell me about last time you had a complete cloud outage? And can you tell me what that was like? And tell me what caused it? And tell me what was involved in recovering? And that has never been a pleasant conversation. Sometimes there have been a couple of times when I'm sure I almost got hit, because there's been a couple of times when I've been meeting with someone and I've said, when was the last time you had a complete cloud outage? And they looked at me and said, right now, I need to be back in the lab I'm like, okay. But it's been a really eye-opening conversation. One of the most startling things to me, and you know, I do want to be clear, I've been talking to, obviously, a lot of Hyper-V customers, but I've been talking to customers on a number of virtualization platforms. The most startling thing to me was no one told me that they had not had a cloud outage in the last 12 months. Everyone told me sometime in the last 12 months, we had an incident that caused a complete cloud service outage. And so we've spent a lot of time gathering data, trying to figure out what the common causes are, and trying to address them. And so I'm really excited to see Windows Server 2016 get out there and see if we can start to tackle this and start to deliver some of the best cloud availability. So the first thing that we heard is, what's the cause of cloud outage? If I have to turn things off to upgrade. That's been a huge pain point. You know, so a big investment has been support for cluster OS rolling upgrade. We've been working on this for years. I'm so happy to see this here work from multiple teams. At any scale point, we can now upgrade you from 2012 R2 to 2016 with zero downtime and zero new hardware. That is really exciting. Just to be clear, 2-node cluster, yes, we can do that. 64-node cluster, yes, we can do that. And the process is really simple. The process is that one at a time, you evacuate the cluster node, you upgrade the OS on that, you go through and you do that on the entire cluster, and when you're done, you then update the cluster functional level to unlock the features of the new operating system. So we have some online sessions where we spend like an hour talking through all the details here, but a couple of things that I want to call out. The first thing is, you know, some common questions that I get here. First one, can I orchestrate this through System Center? Yes, you can. In fact, if you're a System Center customer, we recommend the first thing you do is upgrade System Center Virtual Machine Manager to 2016, and it can then orchestrate this whole process. Next question, what happens if I have a failover event happen while I'm in this mixed mode? Answer, everything works. You know, a big part of this investment has been when you're in this mixed mode environment, you can live migrate in both directions, you can move back and forth, it's completely seamless. Windows Server 2016 will maintain 100% compatibility with 2012 R2. The final thing that excites me about this, because this, to me, this is a really cool thing as someone who spent lots of time in the trenches. Well, let me tell a little story, which I'm sure many of you will relate to. Well, how many of us have had the experience where there's a new operating system, we've been trying it out in our lab, it looks really good, we go through the process of upgrading a production cluster to the new operating system, life is good, and then a week later, life is not good. Because after a week, we discover that something in our environment doesn't work with the new operating system. You know, we have some third-party application, we have some driver, and it wasn't obvious at first, but all of a sudden we're seeing problems. Has anyone had that happen? Couple of hands? Because I know that there's a punchline to this story, because I've heard this story many times. And the punchline is, you'll hit that problem, and you will call the vendor of the hardware or the software, and you will say, I'm having this issue, and invariably their answer will be, yes, we're aware of that, and we will have a fix for that out in 4 months' time. And you're sitting there going, 4 months? My systems are dying today. What can I do? So the really exciting thing here is, with this approach, you can update every server to Windows Server 2016, but you can hang off on updating the cluster functional level while you validate the environment, while you get the level of comfort. And if in that time you find one of these compatibility issues, you can actually roll back the entire cluster to Windows Server 2012 R2 with no downtime. Just follow exactly the same process that got you there. Evacuate a node, and then install Windows Server 2012 R2. Bring it into the cluster, rinse and repeat. So it's a very safe operation with no impact to availability. So behind this is a lot of work we've done around virtual machine upgrades. So we've exposed the concept of virtual machine versions, where you can now manually choose what level of compatibility you want. Version 5 virtual machines are 100% compatible with 2012 R2. Version 8 virtual machines are compatible with 2016. Now I want to talk about some work around failover clustering. We went out and we talked to customers about what was causing outages in their environments. And there were two things that came up time and time again. The first one was networking issues. And this is one of those great, untold stories of IT. I've heard this so many times. There are two stories around networking. The first one is, it's a Thursday afternoon. It's always a Thursday. I don't know why. It's always a Thursday. Life is good. You're at your computer, and then all of a sudden, the networking stops working. Packets aren't going anywhere. Everything's down. Your operations manager is filling with alerts. It's code red. Like you're starting to sweat. And before you can do anything to start to investigate, it's back. This happens. And it's a not uncommon thing, and you just have this momentary outage. Well, the problem that customers then talk to me about is, if that happens to a Hyper-V cluster, dear Lord, it loses its mind. I will have a 30-second network outage, and in that 30 seconds, Hyper-V clustering will have decided to go and shoot every virtual machine in the head and try and start it on a different node, and a 30-second network outage now becomes multiple hours of me trying to get virtual machines back up and running. So we've done a whole lot of work to try and make Hyper-V clustering more intelligent about handling these outages, and I'll show you that in a moment. The next one, though, and this is another common one that we heard about, is I have a Hyper-V cluster, I have a bunch of virtual machines on it, and something goes wrong with the storage. Maybe it's a networking issue, maybe it's a firmware issue with the storage, but something happens and my storage is out of commission for a period of time. Now, everyone understands that, hey, if something goes wrong with your storage, then you're gonna suffer an outage. And people accept that, but the biggest pain point has been the recovery process from that. And I've talked to customers where they had an 8-node Hyper-V cluster with 500 virtual machines on it. They had a storage outage. It took them, for some reason, we keep on jumping forward. It took them 2 hours to triage the storage issue, to get the storage back up and running. It then took them 2 days to get all the virtual machines back up and running. And even at the end of that 2 days, the people I was talking to was like, look, after 2 days, all that we knew was that all the virtual machines had successfully booted to the login prompt. We had a bunch of virtual machines that were running workloads for different customers, for different divisions, where we were just kind of hoping that the applications and the SQL databases and the so on were actually running. So storage resiliency is a feature where now, instead of the pattern today, so let me step through the pattern today. The pattern with 2012 R2 is quite a reasonable engineering pattern, is you have a virtual machine, the guest operating system is trying to write stuff to disk. If we try and write something through to the physical disk and the physical disk isn't there, we return the error message that we get from the underlying storage back to the guest operating system. Now, most operating systems, when they try and write something to a disk and they get a failure message, do what they think is entirely reasonable and they crash. They go, boo, the disk is gone. Time to crash and write out my memory and someone will come along and fix me. Great if it's just a single computer, not great when it's 500 virtual machines. So instead, what we now do in Windows Server 2016 is when we see that write failure happen, we immediately pause the virtual machine. We keep that write and we keep on retrying it until the storage comes back. And in fact, we will wait 24 hours. That is our default setting. So you have 24 hours to go in there to figure out what's gone wrong with the storage and to recover the storage. And the moment that storage comes back online, we resume the virtual machine. So that's a huge saving in downtime. The final thing is in the clustering world is a feature that we call node quarantine. So node quarantine is actually really kind of cool. But this comes from talking to customers about real life problems that they've seen in their environment. And one of the stories that we heard from customers is that they would have a single node in a Hyper-V cluster that was experiencing a transitory hardware issue. You know, the most classic one of this is they would have a piece of hardware, whether it was a CPU or a disk or a network adapter, that was on its last legs, and it was in that window of time where it would work fine until you put load on it. And once it had load on it, it would fall over. And what they would see is that one bad node would slowly destroy the cluster. Because what would happen is there'd be workload on the node, it would have, you know, this hardware issue, all the workload on that node would get, you know, wiped out, and it would get put on different nodes in the cluster. But then now that node was under light load, it would recover, and new workload would get placed on it. And the pattern would repeat. So node quarantine is now where we detect when a cluster node is leaving and rejoining a cluster under its own aegis without an administrator. And if we see that happen too frequently, we mark a node as bad and say, okay, we are not putting workload on this node until a person comes in and checks out what's happening. So that's another big investment here. Another area that we've looked at is guest clustering. How many people here have guest clusters in their environment? Just curious. Okay, I'd say about 15, 20%. How many of you are using shared VHDX? Okay, half of those. Others, please use shared VHDX. So shared VHDX is the technology we delivered in 2012 R2 that allows you to do guest clusters without having to do LUN management. It's just using VHDX, but it's supported in production. The exciting thing about shared VHDX in 2016 is in 2012 R2, you could use shared VHDX and you would get out of the business of LUN management, but you still had all the drawbacks of having a guest cluster. There are a bunch of features that you could not use. Well, with 2016, we can now enable a bunch of those features. So with 2016, you create a guest cluster. One, you can now online resize your shared VHDX. You can grow in response to storage needs. Two, you can enable replica. This is a huge one. You know, it's been a real pain point for people that it's like, I have a workload that I care about so much that I want to cluster it inside the virtual machine, but that means I can't use replica. So now you can use both together. And three, another big one, is you can do host-based backup of these guest clusters. You know, and once again, it was a strange thing that, you know, this workload that you cared about so much that you wanted to use guest clustering didn't work with the Hyper-V backup infrastructure. Well, now it does. For the curious, there is one feature remaining that does not work with a guest cluster if you're using shared VHDX, and that is storage migration. Hopefully, we'll get to that in the future. But apart from storage migration, now every feature that you can use on a standalone virtual machine, you can use on a guest cluster with shared VHDX. I'm trying to ignore an MVP in the front row who I think wants to correct me. Checkpoint. You can kind of use Checkpoint if you know what you're doing. Longer discussion. So I mentioned we have replica for shared VHDX. Another feature that's been added for replica, again in the theme of availability, is the ability to hot add and remove virtual hard drives from virtual machines that are being replicated and to be able to easily update the replicated virtual hard drive set. So keeping on going with availability, in case you haven't guessed, this is a big investment for us. And talking about hot add, there's been a number of hot add features we've added. You can now hot add and remove virtual network adapters. This one, I'm so happy. Oh, it frustrates me to use 2012 R2 now because I can't do this. Another thing that we've added is the ability to add and remove memory from virtual machines that don't have dynamic memory enabled. So you can no longer have to choose dynamic memory or 100% static. You can say, okay, I'm not using dynamic memory on this, but I still want to be able to change the virtual machine as it's running. The final thing in availability, and this is a bit strange to put in availability, but I think it's a really important one to call out, is production checkpoints. So we've had the feature virtual machine checkpoints forever, and forever we have told people, do not use these in production. And forever people have ignored us. It is no exaggeration. Checkpoints is a feature that my team owns directly. When we first released the first version of Hyper-V, we were like, these are not suitable for production. We documented, do not use them in production. And 6 months after Hyper-V had shipped, our number one support call generator was people shooting themselves in the foot using checkpoints in production. And as I like to tell people at Microsoft, if you're the program manager who owns a top support call generator, you get to meet the VP. It's great. It's not great. But I got to sit in the room with the VP of Windows Server saying, okay, what are we going to do about this? And we've been slowly working on this problem, and we've been addressing different issues. But now in Windows Server 2016, we're finally at the stage where we're happy to say, look, you can use checkpoints on production servers. It's fully supported. It's safe. So please, feel free to continue doing what most of you have already been doing and using checkpoints in production. So let me switch across and do some demos of some of the things I've talked about. Now, I'm not going to be able to demonstrate everything, otherwise we would be badly out of time. So I'm going to jump over here. And a disclaimer, I haven't talked about this yet. I have a slide later on to say one of the really cool features in Windows Server 2016 is nested virtualization, the ability to run Hyper-V in Hyper-V. And I am doing that like crazy in this demo. So you're going to see a lot of virtual machines inside of virtual machines. So this the virtual machine here is my management console. It's on my private network, and it's where I have everything set up. I'm going to connect to a cluster. And this is a two-node Hyper-V cluster that I have set up and running with four virtual machines on it. So you can see I have these virtual machines. And I have a little script here that is just going to cause a momentary glitch in my cluster. So cause a problem. And what we'll see is after a couple of seconds, where historically clustering would have seen this glitch and gone, oh, we need to fail over those virtual machines. Instead, now it's going to see it and go like, ooh, I can't access that cluster node anymore, but there were running virtual machines there. I'm going to mark them as unmonitored, and I'm going to wait a moment to see if they come back. Now, by default, with Windows Server 2016, we will wait 4 minutes before we fail over a running virtual machine. Now, running is important. If you have offline virtual machines, we just fail them over straight away. But failing over a running virtual machine is an impactful operation. So we will wait 4 minutes. You can configure that. You can make that shorter or longer as you deem appropriate in your environment. But we will detect that the clusters come back, and we will move those virtual machines back into the running state. This is the awkward thing. It takes anywhere between 1 second to 60 seconds to go out of unmonitored and have to kind of fill the air while we're talking with this. So while that's happening, let's go over here. It should actually say, yep, that my node is isolated. And there, we've just detected that it's coming back, and it's up, and the virtual machines are running. So let's see if we can get into a quarantine situation now. So I'm going to cause the glitch again, see if we go into unmonitored on the virtual machines. And we'll see the virtual machines go unmonitored, the host goes into isolated. And it's actually fixed itself there. So usually the third issue will cause it to go into quarantine. So let's cause a problem again, wait for it to detect that. And now what happens is when we put a host in quarantine and it has running virtual machines, even then we won't do the automatic failover unless we hit the 5-minute timeout. We will put it into quarantine. If it comes back in within the 4 minutes, we will migrate those virtual machines off automatically. We'll say like, okay, we have a brief moment. Let's get that in. Oops, I needed to hit enter. Let's get those virtual machines in and get them onto safe nodes, and then let's put that node aside and wait for administrative action. So waiting for, there we go. And now it's coming back, the node's going into quarantine. So it's still part of the cluster, it's still a member of the cluster, it's there in the cluster. We've migrated the virtual machines off, but we've put it in quarantine. So that's one feature. The other one I want to show you is just, let's run through the hot atom remove. I would love to do the storage resiliency demo. Unfortunately, we're running tight on time. We do have videos online of the storage resiliency, so I'd encourage you to check that out. So I'm going to go over to hot atom remove. Once again, I'm using nested virtualization. For the curious, I've had a lot of people ask me about performance of nested virtualization. Current testing shows that nested virtualization, and by the way, admire the cats in the cats. For the cat people, for the dog people, once again, sorry. For the performance of nested virtualization, the impact is mostly on I/O. For CPU and memory, it's fairly negligible. For I/O, right now, we're seeing about 25% performance impact. So here I have this virtual machine, and it is currently configured with a single network adapter. And I can now hot add network adapters, connect them to the network, and there, nice and simple. And I love doing this. Whenever I do this demo, I have to go crazy and add a whole bunch of network adapters just because it makes me giggle. We're going to throw those all in there. And we've got a whole bunch of network adapters. Yay! And just as I added, I can remove. I can go, okay, Ben, that was too much. And I'm going to remove all those network adapters in one blow. I'll be honest, I love doing this simply because we actually found bugs while doing this. So every time I got on stage, I have to be like, we had problems with this. But now I can go ahead and just remove them all at once, and they're all gone. Yay. So hugely flexible. And this is, by the way, this is one of my top three features that irritates me when I'm using 2012 R2, and it's not there. So the other one is the memory management. So if I bring up the performance over here, you can see this virtual machine currently configured with 900 meg of memory. I can change this up and down while the virtual machine is running, and you'll see it change over here. Once again, very simple, 200 won't work, 1100. I can change it on the fly in response. Now, a little side effect that we got off this that I actually really like is even for virtual machines that now have static memory, we still report the memory demand information. This is hugely useful when sizing memory for virtual machines. So even without enabling dynamic memory, I can get insight into how much memory that virtual machine is using. Okay. I'm running behind time. I knew this would happen. Looking at the timer, so we're going to have to go fast. So storage. Storage is another big area of investment for us. In Windows Server 2012 R2, for the first time, we introduced some storage QoS controls for Hyper-V. In 2012 R2, you can go in and you can set IOPS limits on virtual hard drives. In 2016, we're taking that groundwork and we're extending it in three really important ways. The first way is we are allowing you to set both reserves as well as limits. So you can say, this virtual machine, at least 1,000 IOPS, no more than 2,000 IOPS. So that's the first thing we're doing. The second thing we're doing is we're allowing you to configure your storage QoS settings on your SMB server rather than on your Hyper-V server. Why is that important? It's important because if you have, you know, 15, 20 Hyper-V servers all talking to a single SMB server, the storage cost policies need to be aware of each other. It's no good trying to do that on the endpoint. It needs to be on the storage server. The final thing that we're doing is we're enabling some very fine-grained group policies. So there are two types of group policies that we're enabling here, single instance and multi-instance. The single instance policy is where you can now create a policy and say, for all the virtual machines that are associated with this policy, no more than the sum total. So where is this useful? This is useful, let's say you have a departmental environment and you want to say, okay, you know, finance department, you can have as many virtual machines as you want, doing whatever you want, but sum total, you're not allowed to use more than 20,000 IOPS. You can create a single policy and you can assign all the resources for that department to that policy, and those virtual machines then compete inside that bucket. The other approach is multi-instance. And with multi-instance is where you can specify one policy and say every virtual hard drive that's assigned to this policy gets 200 IOPS. Why is that useful? Because it's really annoying when you have to change the policy on 100 virtual machines. So now if you have a situation where you've set a policy for 100 virtual machines saying these are limited to 200 IOPS, and there's, you know, some decision made where you're like, okay, actually we want to do 300, you can now go change that in one place instead of having to change it on every virtual machine. Another big investment in storage is an investment that we've made in discrete device assignment. This is brand new in Windows Server 2016. We are giving you the ability to take PCIe devices and attach them directly to virtual machines. Now, you lose a lot when you do that. You can't live migrate these virtual machines. You can't checkpoint these virtual machines. But there are a couple of scenarios where we think this is really useful. And on the storage side, one of the scenarios is that we're starting to see this ultra-low latency storage come out, which is very interesting to high-end database workloads and similar things. And in these environments, the overhead of virtualizing storage is noticeable. So we wanted to be able to deliver the lowest overhead storage, and in this model, you pass the controller through to the virtual machine, and there is no overhead. So that's another investment. The next investment that we've made is we've done a huge amount of work investing in backup. And the investments in backup have really been focused at addressing two key issues that we saw when talking to customers and talking to our backup partners. The first issue that we saw was that the Windows Server 2012 R2 backup approach did not scale to large cluster deployments. And as we saw people running large cluster deployments and trying to maintain regular backups, they were hitting so many compatibility issues. And so we worked closely with the VSS team, with the file system team, with the clustering team, and with our backup partners to come up with a new infrastructure that scales to these larger deployments. The next thing that we worked on was building robust change tracking into the platform. So an important detail to understand here is that with Windows Server 2012 R2, in order to get efficient backup of Hyper-V, all of our backup partners had to go out and write kernel mode file system filters in order to do block change tracking because we didn't have that capability in the platform. And no one was happy with that state of affairs. You know, we weren't happy because we knew that having a file system filter affects the performance of all your virtual machines. The backup vendors weren't happy because, let's be honest, no one likes writing kernel mode code. It's not fun. Okay, some people like writing that. Most of them work at Microsoft. But most people don't like writing kernel mode code. And our customers weren't happy because every now and then they would see problems in this environment. And certainly no one was happy, not us, not our backup vendors, not our customers, if they ever saw a blue screen of death and it had the name of their backup software vendor written on that screen. No, that was a bad scene for everyone. So we've done a lot of work to bring this capability natively into the platform so that backup vendors can now utilize it without having to write their own kernel mode components, and so that we can collectively provide a much higher level of availability and a much better, you know, troubleshooting story if and when things do go wrong. The final thing is we've done some great work with the REFS team for REFS accelerated VHD operations. And I'm going to switch over and I'm going to demo this. I will be honest, I was actually planning to demo both the storage costs and the REFS acceleration. Unfortunately, definitely running short on time here. So I'm just going to do the REFS demo. The storage cost demo we have on videos online, and I would encourage anyone who's doing large-scale deployments to look into that. So I have a virtual machine here. This is, once again, a nested instance of Hyper-V. I have an NTFS drive, I have an RFS drive, and both of these have a parent disk and a differencing disk. I'm going to show two things that we have done to make REFS a great file system for Hyper-V. And actually, I had someone come to me just this morning and say, what are your thoughts about using REFS in Windows Server 2016 as my storage for virtual hard drives? And my answer was, you should absolutely do it. Like, it is awesome. I am really excited to look forward, I'm really looking forward to moving all of my storage across to REFS. And let me show you why. So I'm going to use a nice little PowerShell command, measure command. And measure command tells you how long a chunk of PowerShell takes to run. I'm going to say new VHD. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to create some fixed VHDs. So N colon is my NTFS drive. Test. I'm going to create a fixed VHD, and I'm going to make it 10 gig. So not a huge one, but good for demo purposes. So this is going to go ahead and create a fixed. Now, I have some nice SSD storage here. It's nice and fast. But what's happening right now is, to highlight, NTFS was first built 15 years ago before people did crazy things like this. And so what's happening right now is we're going out and we are writing 10 gig of data to the disk. We are writing 10 gig of zeros. And that took, if we highlight, that took 21 seconds. And that whole 21 seconds, my hard drive light was on solid as we wrote 10 gig of data. Now, if I do the same thing on my REFS drive, what you're going to see is 1 second. And the reason for the difference there is because REFS has the intelligence that we can go to it and say, we want a file that looks like this. We want 10 gig, zeroed out, guaranteed clean data. And it can go like, oh, I have that. Let me go find that and map that to a file rather than writing it all out. So that's great. But the one that I really like is what happens with disk merging. So once again, let's do a measure command. I'm going to do merge VHD. And we're going to use the NTFS drive first. I've got my differencing disk. And we're going to just merge it into the parent that is right there next to it. So once again, on NTFS, what is happening right now is we are taking every bit out of the differencing disk, and we are manually copying it into the parent. And not only does this take time, but if you could see the hard drive light on my laptop, it is on solid. It is on solid, and this is having a performance impact on everything else running on the system because NTFS doesn't have the intelligence about what's going on here. So that took about 31 seconds. Same files, but this time on REFS. And this takes 2 seconds. Same data. What happened? Well, the important thing to understand is no data had to move. Like, all the data that we needed was there already. We just had to have faith in ourselves. No. All the data was there. And what we did was with REFS, we were able to go to REFS and say, we have this base disk and we have this differencing disk and all the data is there on drive. Can you just give us a new file description that is what we should see if we combine these two? And without moving any data, it gives us a new file description. So not only is that so much faster, but it has zero impact on other workload running on my system. So now I'm going to try and do a speed run before we get to our last demo set. A ton of stuff to jump through. So graphics. Graphics has been a huge area of investment for us. We have our remote effects technology, which is great for people who want to do VDI deployments. A whole swarm of features here. We now have remote effects support for Generation 2 virtual machines. We have support for using OpenGL inside of virtual machines running remote effects, both OpenGL 4.4 and OpenCL 1.1. We've increased the amount of VRAM you can associate with it. We have added a whole bunch of new transport improvements. One of the ones which I have a guy on my team who is an absolute video buff, he gets really excited about, so I have to call this out, is the AVC 444. Now, if you're not a video buff, you'll be going, what does that mean? It is a lossless codec, so we can now do lossless, high-definition 3D rendering coming out of a virtual machine. So huge amount of investment there. But on top of that, we've had customers who have said, we need even more graphics capability than that. And there, we're supporting discrete device assignment for GPUs into virtual machines. Now, there are very specific hardware requirements about this. We have a set of blog posts on our team blog that go into details on how to set this up. But with high-end video cards, you can now pass entire GPUs through to get native graphics performance inside a virtual machine. The final thing on graphics is going in completely the opposite direction is we've added the ability to have headless virtual machines. I'll show you what this looks like in a little bit, but if you have a virtual machine that's just running a web service, why load a graphics driver? Why use the memory? Why have the processed footprint of that? You can now go in and say, fine, at any stage, just pull the video card out of this virtual machine. So now a bunch of things that I call operational efficiency. One of my favorite features in the release, PowerShell Direct. This is amazing technology. It gives you the ability to get a PowerShell session inside a virtual machine from the host operating system with zero configuration and no dependency on networking. If you have Windows 10 or Windows Server 2016 in a VM, it is just there and it just works. Now, this has been there since Windows 10. Something that we introduced last November on top of PowerShell Direct, which I think is really exciting for server environments, is the ability to do PowerShell Direct to JEA endpoints. So not enough people have really got their head around JEA, just enough administration. So let me step you through the great scenario that you could have for this. When we go out and we talk to customers and hosters and customers of hosters, there's this friction point that comes up. And the friction point goes like this. I buy a virtual machine from a hoster. I do not want that hoster to have admin access to my virtual machine, and I don't want him or her tampering with my virtual machine. On the flip side, I talk to the hoster, and they sit there and go like, do you want to know what our number one support call is? Our number one support call is stupid customers shooting themselves in the foot, disabling networking. And what do they do when that happens? They call up the hoster, and they're like, can you fix my network? And so there's this friction where what tends to happen is the hoster tries to add themselves as an admin by default. People get upset about that. Sometimes they remove the hoster from admin group. Then when they hit a problem, they call up the hoster, and the hoster's like, well, you removed me from the admin group. There's nothing I can do. So what PowerShell Direct and JEA together allows a hoster to do is a hoster can create a JEA endpoint definition that says, don't give me access to the file system. Don't give me access to all the myriad of things I can do with PowerShell. Just give me access to the PowerShell commandlets for configuring networking. And set that up in the virtual machine, allow the customer to see that, okay, they only have access to networking. And now, if there's a problem, they can connect, fix that problem, and just that problem, and they don't have access to the rest of the system. So that's really cool functionality to see. Another just operational efficiency. This is another one. I think a lot of us have had this experience, is you have a virtual machine, you've imported it into an environment, you've restored it from a backup, but you know, you're trying to bring it online, and you're sitting there inside the virtual machine, and you're going, one of these NICs is connected to the production network, and one is to the private network. And which one is which again? And if we're honest, most of us just kind of roll the dice and go, I think it's okay to put this setting on this NIC, and we kind of sit there and wait, and we panic. So we now have the ability to define virtual network adapter names in the host operating system, which you can then read inside the virtual machine, so you can know for sure which network adapter is which. We've also made a bunch of improvements to Hyper-V Manager. We've added support for alternate credentials. So if you're managing a system where you're not logged in as admin, we added support for connecting by IP address because it turns out that there are other people out there who are just as bad at managing DNS as I am. If you've watched demos over the years, I often get DNS configuration issues. So you can use IP address. We support connecting via WinRM, so it's easier to do through a firewall. And we've improved our functionality on high DPI devices. On top of this, we've done a whole lot of work for cross-version management. So you have Windows 10 Anniversary Update Edition on your laptop. That instance of Hyper-V Manager can manage Windows Server 2016. It can manage Windows Server 2012 R2. It can manage Windows Server 2012. It can manage all those versions from a single console. Another kind of operational efficiency thing that we did was we changed the way we do integration services. Now, integration services are the components that run inside a virtual machine that provide all the virtualized devices. And we did a bunch of research on this because we were discussing, hey, we should stop doing the whole virtual machine integration services ISO, and we should push this through Windows Update. We were concerned that making this change would be problematic. So we did a bunch of customer research to see how people would feel if we went from the Windows Server 2012 R2 experience, where there's the menu entry, to an experience where it just goes through Windows Update. Now, the results we got were not what we expected. What we were expecting was we were expecting about 70% of people to go like, that seems okay, and about 30% of people to have complaints and issues, and we would work through it. We were worried that we'd get 70% of people going like, no, and 30% of people going like, yeah, that's okay. Instead, what we got was we got 80% of people going, what are integration services? And what we realized was that the vast majority of our customers had never updated integration services, were running with woefully out-of-date virtual machine drivers, and we're not getting the performance they should have been getting. We're seeing problems, and that's where we said, okay, fine, we have to solve this problem. So we are now, this no longer, the ISO file that gets injected is pushed out through Windows Update, and one of the things I'm really happy about is we've been working with the engineering team and with the servicing team, and in the coming month, what's actually going to happen is we are going to push out updated integration services to virtual machines that are running on Windows Server 2012 R2 so that, one, we've tested that it's fully compatible, but now, if and when those virtual machines get upgraded to a Windows Server 2016 host, they already have the drivers that they need to get the best performance on that platform. So I'm going to skip over this demo. I'm going to jump back because we're running close on time. Some core platform improvements. NanoServer. How many people here know about NanoServer? Fantastic. That's like 80% of the audience, but I want it to be 100. Now for the awkward question, how many people here have tried NanoServer? That is better than it's been. We're like 40%, but come on, people, let's get to 100%. If you don't know what I'm talking about, NanoServer is the ultra-low, minimal footprint deployment for Hyper-V. I want to be crystal clear. I know I am going to get asked about this, and it's going to drive me crazy. No questions asked, NanoServer is our number one recommended host for Hyper-V. Full stop. In 6 months' time, if I talk to anyone in this room and you are not running NanoServer as your host, you're going to have to tell me why. Because it is the best option. It has the best security. It has the lowest patch. It has the lowest resource utilization. It is exactly what you want for a Hyper-V server. So please, start using NanoServer. We've also added support for nested virtualization, which I've been using heavily through this demo. I had to smile. This is kind of a trap question, so I won't wait for someone to ask me. I had someone actually come up to the booth this morning and say, "So this nested virtualization, is it really production ready?" And my answer was, "Well, we built it for Azure, and they're in the middle of deploying it, so I think it is." We built nested virtualization to enable Azure to offer Hyper-V containers in virtual machines on Azure Fabric. Secondary benefit, we all get it on our systems, and it's great. It is very easy to build lab environments, to build test environments, and it's really useful. We've made changes to the virtual machine configuration file. I don't have enough time to go into this. I will call out. It's a different file. We're going to be providing lots of information about why that is. We've made a lot of changes to power management. So why have we done this? We have done this partly because of Paul Thoreau, but also because of all the people who observed that Hyper-V was causing power drain on their new fancy Surface devices. And I do want to highlight this last tweet here is the really painful one, because this is, I was trying to use a laser pointer, but I couldn't, so let me highlight. This one here, that is the official Twitter account from the Surface team telling someone maybe they should just turn off Hyper-V. That hurts. So Windows 10 Anniversary Update, Windows Server 2016, Connected Standby Mode works. We did a whole lot of work to make sure that we have absolutely minimal power impact. We also did work to start exposing Hyper-V management concepts at the cluster level. And we have some great new functionality for our development partners, which we call Hyper-V sockets. This is something that we're really looking forward to seeing what people do. For ages, Hyper-V's been a great platform to run your workload on. It hasn't been a great platform to build new apps on. And so what we've actually done is we're starting to provide primitives where software vendors can build new solutions on top of Hyper-V, and Hyper-V sockets is a key part of that offering. The final thing I have to talk about, then I'll switch across to final demo and questions, is scale. And we got a bit carried away with scale. The Hyper-V MVPs were actually asking us if we're going to change our scale limits, and we are. We now support up to 24 terabyte per virtual machine of memory per physical machine, up to 512 logical processes in a physical machine. There is an error on this page. It says 16 terabyte. It should say 12. So it's actually 12 terabyte of memory per virtual machine, and up to 240 virtual processors. I do want to take a moment to talk about this, because I know that a lot of people will be going, "Why do I care? I'm never going to have that sort of hardware. You guys are crazy. Why did you spend time on that?" And the answer is yes. You're probably never going to have that sort of hardware. But fortunately, we have a really big customer who does. It's a thing called Azure. And they came to us and they said, "Hyper-V team, we want to offer our customers the biggest virtual machines imaginable. Because we've been talking to customers, and we have customers which have, where they have needs for massive scale for a couple of months. And that's a real problem for them. They don't want to go out and buy a supercomputer for just a couple of months. And so we're working with the Azure team so that they can bring out offerings of massive scale virtual machines so that people who need this can get it from the public cloud. So I'm going to quickly switch across. I do want to show a couple of demos that I'll show resources and open for questions. I've got the blinky light. We are 12 seconds over, so I apologize for that. But I do want to quickly show a couple of demos. The first one is I want to bring up my nano server. So this is one of my nested servers. This is nano server. We've actually continued to refine this. So one of the big pieces of feedback that we heard from people with the early technical previews of nano server was they had concerns around troubleshooting and support. So it's always our goal that nano server, you should never touch the console. It should all be remote management. But we did want to make sure that in the worst case scenario, you can understand what's happening and you can recover from it. So a couple of things to call out here. This is a Hyper-V nano server. I could come in here. I can see basic networking information. If I have a network configuration issue, I can change, I can change my IP settings from here. I can also, because everyone's had this moment where they're like, is something up with my Hyper-V server? So I can come in here, I can go to VM host, which you will only see if Hyper-V is enabled, and I can say, show me the guest status, please. And at the nano server console, this will then just give me a nice little readout of what virtual machines are running, their CPU usage, their memory usage. This is a read-only console, but it's just a nice, easy way for me to be like, okay, everything's fine here. I'm going to go look somewhere else for my troubleshooting. We had a lot of debate about this. When we talked to customers about nano server and about it being all remote management, a concern point that got raised was, what happens if I break virtual networking? So we did provide a simple little emergency escape rope here, and that is we have the ability to delete a virtual switch. So if you see down the bottom, there's F10 remove virtual switch. So that's an emergency line. And while we're here, I will just quickly show, actually I have a headless virtual machine here. This guy, you'll see he doesn't have a thumbnail. He doesn't have a video adapter. All works fine. So with all that, let's jump back a couple of resources and then question time. So some resources. We have a bunch of sessions this week. We had, I believe the Linux session was yesterday. If these sessions have happened, they're recorded. We have the two sessions going into shielded virtual machines. We have sessions talking about containers. We have sessions talking about hyper-converged infrastructure. And we have sessions talking about our storage work. We also have a bunch of online resources. So I've given you a quick run through. Please hit up these links. I would strongly recommend the Virtual Academy, where me and Matt McSpirit spend 8 hours covering this content. And we get to go in a lot more detail in 8 hours than I've able to do in 75 minutes. So with that, thank you, everyone. And happy to answer questions people have.